Well, on Friday, the Australian Academy of Science ran a full-day seminar on this country's future energy needs, Power for the People. Yes, the usual smorgasbord with signs of progress for the doubtful. One of the speakers was Sir David King, former chief scientist in Britain. Here he is speaking rather more generally at the Academy dinner on Thursday night.
When I became chief scientific advisor, you've got to imagine this. I am a physical chemist. I'd been working in the research lab with amazing young research students all my career, nearly 40 years, and then suddenly you're offered this post in government. And it was like stepping into a room with no lights on. I had no idea what was involved. And the very first thing that happened to me was the world's biggest foot and mouth disease epidemic. And as a physical chemist, I can tell you I couldn't even get the word epidemiology across my lips. So it was to be serious for a moment, a discovery of the unity of science. Because the models for following a virus traveling from one farm to another, the mathematics was very similar to models I had published in the 1980s on the diffusion of molecules on solid surfaces. So it was really rather a pleasure to work with a bunch of epidemiologists and find that I could not only understand what they were doing, but also challenge. And the role of chief scientific advisor is precisely that, to bring in the top experts, challenge them, distill it down, and then give clear advice to government. Now, in that foot and mouth disease outbreak, what we did was model, and then we introduced a new mode of containing the epidemic. And it was considered to be very draconian by many, and I got heavily criticized in the media, and becoming media savvy was the first part of the job. We had exponential growth in our epidemic in terms of the number of farms that were infected, and by the time we'd finished our modeling, working 24/7, we had something like 45 new infected farms reported every day. And I simply went into the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and I said, we could actually turn exponential growth to exponential decay within 2 days. Now, this was a Prime Minister in a bit of a flurry, because every newspaper knew that he was planning to go to the country for a general election on the 5th of May that year, and our graphs were showing that the epidemic was going to be at enormous proportions on the 5th of May. And no one else had indicated how this might be brought under control. So suddenly I was put in charge of the entire operation, including, and this is what prime ministers and government ministers do, putting the white coat onto television and radio. Now, of course, I knew that it was my head on the block. If it didn't work, then the chief scientific advisor would be gone tomorrow and the prime minister would stay. I was fairly confident about what we were doing. And as we passed that peak 2 days later, with this rather draconian policy in place, the Prime Minister said to me, please tell me when you're confident that we're on your exponential decay curve. And so a week later, I went into him. I was seeing him twice a day through this period. I went into him and I said, Prime Minister, I'm pretty confident now. And I showed him the graphs. And this, I believe, is probably the only occasion in which a prime minister has chosen a date of election on the basis of a computer printout from our prediction on the epidemic. Right, so when the epidemic on a linear plot dropped to one new farm a day, it looked like it was over. So he called the election for June the 6th. And that was based entirely on looking at that plot. It worked very well. He was re-elected. Before the foot and mouth disease epidemic, we'd had another problem with our farms. The first was the well-known BSE crisis. And that was not handled too well by government ministers who were very, very keen to see that Britain would keep selling beef. That was the prime target. And so when you get a minister going on television feeding his daughter with a hamburger made from freshly minced cow meat, you can see just how bad this was getting. This was a major problem when I came into government, because the trust of the public in the scientific establishment was what was put to blame. And I had to take a very simple mantra, which Tony Blair, to his credit, accepted at least at the beginning, which was, I tell you what my advice is, and then I put the advice always into the public domain, whatever your decision is, whether you act on it or not. And that was a means of getting public trust back. Now, BSE is very, very similar to Scrapie and Sheep. It's extremely difficult, actually, scientifically, to distinguish the two. And so a very real question was suddenly asked, which is, are the sheep that are falling over with Scrapie actually all falling over with Scrapie? Or has BSE gone into the sheep population as well? And so we sent off samples of sheep brain to a range of scientists around the world. It took them 7 years to come back with the results. This was a difficult challenge. And when the results came back, it was very, very clear that BSE was present in sheep brain. So what I was sitting with this information was a red button on my desk, which meant death to every sheep in Britain. This was quite a terrible potential decision. So I called all these experts from around the world to sit with me for a day. And during the period, I simply said to them, what was the chance that the sheep brain samples, sheep brains were all chucked in a bucket, minced up, and samples sent around the world, that the sheep brain samples had been contaminated with beef brains or with the blood from beefs in the abattoirs from which they were collected? And they all said, no, no, every brain was carefully washed, etc. Well, it turns out that I was the only one asking the question, and has anyone done a DNA test? Nobody had conducted a DNA test. So I sent samples to the laboratory for the government chemist, and the LGC director called me up and said, I hope you're sitting down. And he said, those samples that you sent us are 100% bovine. There was no contamination from sheep brain in the samples that were sent. Now, what had happened was buckets of the two lots of brains had been collected from abattoirs, and the buckets had been labeled LG/5/53 and LG/5/52, and somebody had muddled them up. So for 7 years, the wrong brains were tested, and it was correctly proved, good for the scientists, that they had BSE. So Lord Sainsbury, who was the science minister, said to me, you've probably just saved the country about £10 billion with this decision to do the DNA test. The test was subsequently, of course, continued, and it turns out that our sheep hadn't picked up BSE. Well, if I then say a little bit about energy, because climate change was always going to be at the top of my agenda, and my agenda kept getting swept aside by these other issues. Fusion was mentioned earlier on, and I decided to make a big push for fusion, because I believe that there is a potential for creating energy into the future from lithium and deuterium, which can continue for thousands of years. And so a potential solution on a very large scale to the energy stroke climate change problem. In the middle of this, I went in to see the Prime Minister, who said to me, I'm confused. What is the difference between fusion and fission? And Tony Blair, to his credit, would sit there and listen carefully as I described the difference. And he would want to know, so how come you combine two atoms and you get energy, and you split an atom and you get energy? And then I knew he was beginning to get the answer. It took me about 40 minutes, and then, as usual, the barrister in him, he would then say, fine, I've got it. Let me see if I... He wouldn't take any notes, and he just gave me back in 20 minutes what he'd just learned. 3 months later, I've got to give you the key to this story. So I had been into the United States, Secretary for Energy, trying to persuade them to join the International Fusion Program. And the answer came back negative. The Undersecretary was a person I got on with very well, and he said, there's only one way to do this, and that's to persuade your Prime Minister to tell our President that he should do it. So 3 months after I'd briefed him on fusion, Blair called me up, it was a Saturday night, and said, I'm just getting in a plane to go to Camp David, I'm going to raise fusion tonight. Can I just take you through the fusion story again? And he repeated it almost word for word. This is a man with a remarkable memory. It was a few weeks after he came back before I saw him, and I was very anxious, of course, do we have America on board or not? And so when I saw him, he said, well, do you want the good news or the bad news first? And so I said, well, give me the bad news. And he said, well, the bad news is that I started saying to George next to the fire after dinner, let me tell you about fusion. It's really fascinating. And George said, forget that. He said, I don't want to hear about it. Are you for or against? And Tony said, well, I'm for. And he said, here comes the good news. George said, fine, we're in. After persuading the British government that climate change was a major challenge and really a major challenge to the British Isles, we're faced with flooding risks, both from fluvial flooding, changes in rainfall pattern, and from rising sea levels. And in Parliament, actually, when I presented maps of Britain and showed what it was going to look like in 2080 on the business as usual, there were parliamentarians who asked me not to put this into the public domain because their constituencies were going underwater. So the lesson I learned from this was that you have to show the threat and at the same time show solutions. Well, Blair said to me, fine, now you're going to spend most of the rest of your time traveling around the world persuading governments. There wasn't a minute when I wasn't a very, very busy person, and at the same time, in many ways, very rewarding. And the rewarding side of it, believe it or not, comes from sticking your neck out. So when I made that statement in the preamble to going to Seattle to deliver an opening address at the AAAS meeting, I published a paper in Science suggesting that climate change was more serious even than global terrorism. This divided the American population very clearly in two and led to a very difficult time with my prime minister. Let me say that I believe the difficult time came from the President of the United States, who thought that he could instruct our Prime Minister to get rid of his chief scientific advisor. But it did mean that I was no longer allowed into meetings with the President, and I was never allowed to accompany Blair even to the G8+5 on climate change that I had been the generator of. So there can be difficult times as well as enjoyable, but I think the important thing as a chief scientific advisor, and I leave you with this, throughout your career in science, there is one thing you know that you have, and that is your scientific integrity. And if you go into a job in government, what you've got to make sure of is that you hang on to that come hell or high water. Thank you.
Sir David King, former chief scientist in the UK.